Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with life coach Cindy Chavez. Today is Wednesday. Happy Neville Day, everybody. Wednesday, December the 11th, 2019, 4 p.m. New York time. But wherever you are in the world, thank you for joining us for another episode of LOA Today, your daily dose of happy. And I'm muting things as I'm talking here just to make sure I've got everything going good. it's been an interesting week for me. I've been telling people a little bit here on the show about all this programming I've been working on lately, Cindy, and I was telling you about it just before we got started on it on the show today. And I'm learning stuff about programming, but I'm also learning a lot of LOA stuff, which we kind of talked about leading up to the show starting here. And I won't go through all of it, but one of the things I really noticed today, there's a lot of metaphors you can draw from programming that are directly or indirectly related to what we talk about often when it comes to applying the law of attraction in our lives. And of course, there's also the thing about programming your subconscious mind and programming yourself for success and all that sort of thing. But I was also noticing, and I mentioned this to you, when you do computer programming, you have to be very meticulous about every single little thing that you do. You have to work it through one careful little step at a time. And it occurred to me, boy, that's so micromanaging, and it's so anti what we're taught about law of attraction. Law of attraction, you just go to the end result. You don't go through all that because you'll drive yourself crazy, first of all. Source energy can do it so much easier. And second of all, you know, why would you have to even do that? You just go to the end result and it comes out easier, you know. But here I am very meticulously, like all programmers do, piecing together this little thing. And I thought that's really ironic. I wonder what all that means from a metaphorical perspective about what I'm learning about this. And I don't have a full answer yet, but I think part of it is I'm learning to let go because, boy, you do enough of this very intricate, you know, managing the whole thing, and you say to yourself, boy, is it really nice to just go to that last step? I mean, it's just the best thing in the world.
Well, you were saying something right before the show started about doing something differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of, I mean, that's actually a little trick, if you will. It's an energy shifter that I've heard therapists do this, ask for this. I've heard coaches do it. And the idea is when things seem stuck, which you were talking about a repetitive task that just was draining you because it's just the same thing over and over and over. When things feel like that, to do something differently.
Yes.
And literally it can be something really simple in your daily routine, but it's to shake the routine up. So it's like, if you usually drive a certain route to work, take a different route. Or if you usually have breakfast and then get dressed, try getting dressed and then having breakfast. You know, just shaking up the order of things, because we get in these patterns where everything is pretty much like exactly the same. And then we wonder why we're feeling stuck. But it's like everything's the same and it's draining. It on one hand, it feels like it's easy because we're kind of like on autopilot. But also, things don't shift as easily because we're not really allowing them to. We're staying. I always talk about the difference between being in a groove and being in a rut.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it reminded me of that. It's just a good thing to remember is that when you're feeling stuck, just do some things a little bit different. Shake up your routine a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I think what you were referring to was in our earlier conversation before the show, I talked about how I had been getting really frustrated because it just felt like I was just slogging through this mucky, gunky stuff that just moves so slowly. And I was expressing my frustration to Louise and trying to work my way through, how do I find where the good side is on all this? I mean, we talk about that on the show all the time, right? Pivoting to the good stuff. And I couldn't seem to find it. But I just kept after it. I kept trying to find it, kept trying to look. And all of a sudden, I found myself just kind of wrapping my arms around the fact that I had this routine that you just described, the repetitive tasks. I had this repetitive task that I had to do literally every 10 seconds or so doing this programming work. And during the course of doing that repetitive task, I would have to do, you know, switching from one screen to the next, and it wouldn't always switch. And so I'd have to do it again, and then it would finally switch, and then I'd go back and start doing this for another 10 seconds, and then I had to go do this other thing. And it wouldn't work right away. And so I started building up this real frustration level. But I
think it all gets worse.
Much, really fast, too, I might add. You know? But I didn't make the mental connection because, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, you're just dealing with this frustration and, okay, I'll get through it. I'll get through it. But it just keeps building up and building up. And I hadn't noticed what it was that was building up. Well, I finally noticed it. And I noticed it because I kind of embraced it. I kind of said, you know, okay, here's what I'm dealing with every day. Why am I feeling this way? And that's when it finally hit me. Oh, God, yes, I have these same repetitive tasks that don't always work that I keep having to repeat every 10 seconds and get frustrated every 10 seconds. No wonder I don't like this stuff.
Right, exactly.
So I made one little change. I brought in a second computer, set it up so that I would run into that frustration of not getting it to work. And, oh, my God, the whole thing just started to flow. Today, I did, like, twice as much as I did yesterday.
Oh, that's
amazing.
Just
by making that one change.
Yeah. Incredible. And see, that's the thing. If you've ever spoken to someone that was stuck with a manifesting issue, like, I have some friends that flip houses. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, they get a house that, you know, it just wasn't selling. And they're ready to sell it. They needed to sell it, you know, and move to the next one, right? And it wouldn't sell. And more than once, they have been at that frustration point of not having this thing moving and then saying, oh, well, you know what? We're going to go ahead and leave for the holiday and go visit family or whatever. And we're just going to have a good time. You know, it's nothing we can do. They're out of town for 2 days. They get a call. The house is sold. Right. I mean, this is a story that you'll hear from a lot of people that we used to joke about it and say, time to get out of town. Because when you get out of town, things start shifting. And I think that part of that is connected to the idea that you're not in your usual routine. Things start to unstick because you unstick because you're somewhere else. And they also say that scientists talk about your brain when you're in a different place physically, like you go visit another city that you're not familiar with, that everything about how your brain is working, you become hypervigilant because you can't go on autopilot because you don't know the streets. You don't know where the things are. So you start really paying attention. That's another thing that will cause, you know, things to shift. So I love it. I'm glad it's going better for you now.
It is. It's much better. I mean, I'm feeling good. I'm making progress. And we had also talked that I'm actually going through an educational course online, learning this new platform. And almost near the end of having gone through it once. And with this kind of stuff, you usually go through it once. If you're somebody who's more advanced than I am, they get it the first time around. Me, once I've gone through it once, I have to go through it again. But the second time around should be a whole lot easier.
Right.
So I feel like I'm getting almost through the most difficult part of all, and then things are going to start opening up. So it's good stuff. Good stuff.
Very good. Very good.
Now I know whenever I bring up something like this to start off the show, it ties in ultimately with what we're going to read next from Neville. So I'm curious to see how is this going to tie into what Neville's telling us.
I
think it's going to be there.
So, yeah, we'll see. Any announcements before we dive in?
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about people who are not yet subscribers, which are a very small number of our audience. I told Alex and Dan yesterday, I took a little tally, and we are now averaging 494 as of yesterday, 494 listeners per show on average. So we're almost at 500. We're like that close. Now,
right.
I can't always say that it's always going to be upward. I mean, it bounces up and down, so maybe it'll bounce down. But you know, it could also bounce up, but we're that close. So we're hoping more and more people become subscribers right now who are not yet subscribers. If you're in that camp, just go to the homepage of our website, loatoday.net, and you'll see instructions right at the top of the page for how to become a subscriber. Dan actually did this recently and assured me it was one click. I can't say it's always one click for everybody, but it's pretty simple. We've made it about as simple as we can make it. And also, when you've done that, make sure you go to YouTube, too, and subscribe to us there, because when we live stream, when we record our podcast, we live stream to YouTube while we're doing that, so you can actually see us while we're doing this in addition to hearing us. And then click the little bell to be notified whenever we are putting out something new on YouTube. But whatever you do, make sure you subscribe so that you keep getting all the episodes 5 days a week coming right to your device. And those are the announcements for today. So let's do a little Nevilleizing.
All right, let's do it. Nevilleizing. I love it. So those of you who are Nevilleites and come listen to Neville Day on Wednesdays know that we've almost completed all of the books that Neville has written. We have not delved into his lectures, so there's lots of material, but we began a couple weeks ago with the book Seed Time and Harvest. And so that's where we are. We're on chapter 3. And as usual, I will just say that we started with the Neville books that used the least amount of Christian Bible verses when we first started.
Dear people that we are.
And now we've gotten to the end, and we're like, okay, I guess we have to dive into these. But I think it's been really good because along the way, we joke about the Neville decoder ring, but along the way, we've begun to understand how Neville treats and navigates these verses.
Yes.
And it's usually not like anything any of us were taught in church or Sunday school or, you know, whenever we've heard the Bible read, because, you know, Neville considers himself, and I think he's used this word to describe himself, a Christian mystic.
Mm.
And so he looks at all of these verses in a very metaphysical way. He does not believe that any of them are literal or historical. He believes that the Christian Bible and the Jewish Bible are, I think he calls them psychological dramas.
Right.
And so he's always looking at it that way, which makes it really interesting. So he, in this chapter, the chapter is called The Gift of Faith, and he begins with a Bible verse from the book of Genesis, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and in his offerings, but unto Cain and to his offering he had no respect. Neville says, if we search the scriptures, we will become aware of a far deeper meaning in the above quotation than that which a literal reading would give us. The Lord is no other than your own consciousness. Say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. I am is the self-definition of the Lord. Cain and Abel, as the grandchildren of the Lord, can be only personifications of two distinct functions of your own consciousness. The author is really concerned to show the two contrary states of the human soul, and he has used two brothers to show these states. The two brothers represent two distinct outlooks on the world possessed by everyone. One is the limited perception of the senses, and the other is an imaginative view of the world. Cain, the first view, is a passive surrender to appearances and an acceptance of life on the basis of the world without, a view which inevitably leads to unsatisfied longing or a contentment with disillusion. Abel, the second view, is a vision of a fulfilled desire, lifting man above the evidence of the senses so that the state of relief where he no longer pines with desire. Ignorance of the second view is a soul on fire. Knowledge of the second view is the wing whereby it flies to the heaven of fulfilled desire. This is very interesting.
It is, yeah. Especially those last two lines. That one really got my attention. Ignorance of the second view is a soul on fire.
Yeah.
What he's describing there, the able view, which is the imaginative view, he's basically describing how when someone is not using or utilizing their imagination to the fullest and just relying on their senses, they are essentially in a really tough space, or as he describes it, a soul on fire. It's a very painful alliterative tool he used there. And so when you read it, it's like, oh yeah, I know what that one feels like.
Right. So he then quotes some verses. The first one's from Proverbs. Come eat my bread and drink of the, I think it's supposed to be wine.
Yes, wine is what I have in mind.
So. Okay, I have a typo. Come eat my bread and drink of the wine that I have mingled. Forsake the foolish and live. The next verse is from Hebrews. It says, in the epistle to the Hebrews, the writer tells us that Abel's offering was faith and states the author, without faith, it is impossible to please him. And then another verse from Hebrews. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. So remember that the title of the chapter is The Gift of Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And he's showing us two sides of the coin here, which he says are the two sides of our consciousness, right?
Yeah.
He says Cain offers the evidence of the senses, which consciousness, the Lord, rejects. Now, remember, we talked about a minute ago about the Neville decoder ring. Mm-hmm. So whenever you hear Neville talking about the Lord, he says that that is our consciousness. So, or our imagination.
Which right? he underlined with that last sentence. So, yes.
Yeah. So Cain offers the evidence of the senses, which consciousness the Lord rejects, because acceptance of this gift as a mold of the future would mean the fixation and perpetuation of the present state forever. The sick would be sick, the poor would be poor, the thief would be a thief, the murderer a murderer, and so on, without hope of redemption. So we talk about this a lot on our show. Mm-hmm. We talk about perpetuating what is, right? Being fixated on what is. And that's what he's talking about, the evidence of the senses. The Lord, or consciousness, has no respect for such passive use of imagination, which is the gift of Cain. He delights in the gift of Abel, the active, voluntary, loving exercise of the imagination on behalf of man for himself and others.
Let me take a moment before you go on there.
Yeah.
Because that's an interesting phrase. He has no respect for such passive use of imagination. And that's actually saying it a little bit differently from the way he said it in the beginning. At the very beginning, the direct quote was, "But unto Cain and to his offerings he had not respect." Now he's saying he has no respect for such passive use of imagination. And I think this is a really important thing, because he described Cain as being the representation of paying attention to the senses.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just, I just know there are many people out there, many who are avid Neville followers, mm-hmm. who will basically take that pretty literally and say, pay no attention to the senses. The senses are bad for you. They're not good at all. Which is not what he actually ends up saying here. What he actually ends up saying is, instead of paying attention to the senses as something to be accepted or rejected, it's give them no respect for being for using imagination so passively. So it isn't the senses he's talking about, it's the passive use of imagination.
What I think is interesting is that, remember, when he says the Lord has no respect for such passive use of imagination, but he's already told us that the Lord is our consciousness.
Right.
And we've spoken before about how our consciousness is creating things. And I almost think you could change this word respect to regard. Like, our consciousness has no yes. regard for us using our imagination so passively. In other words, if we're going to use our imagination so passively, our consciousness is not going to create anything new. It's just passive. Things exactly. continue as they are.
Yeah. And that's a great replacement. That's like an adjunct to the Neville decoder ring, I think. Putting in regard in place of respect. Because respect, that does tend to have sort of a moralistic thing to it. Regard basically means I'm not paying attention to it.
Yeah,
I'm just turning it off. Yeah.
It's like, and
this is important. I really want to hammer this point home. I think it's really important to recognize Neville is not rejecting what we would call physical reality. He's not saying physical reality is bad in any way. He's simply right. saying spend more time imagining. Imagination is where the good things happen. So, you know, put your attention there. It's kind of like what Abraham points out, that they get people in their hot seat, right? And in the hot seat, somebody will come in and they'll just go on and on about what is, the very thing we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. You're ignoring what is. You know, there's all this what is going on, and you're pretending that it's not even there. And Abraham's response was, "We love you. We love you because people like you are what keep this whole physical thing going. It's your attention to it that makes that work." You know, so again, this I know Abraham and Neville are often considered to be two different qualities. I consider them to be just great teachers that work together nicely, but other people don't always see it that way. But even so, Abraham and Neville, I think, are really in agreement here. They're basically saying there's nothing wrong with physical reality. In fact, all the signals we get from psychics and mediums and so forth about what this world is viewed as from that perspective is, this is like the stage. This is where all the good stuff is happening. This is the leading edge. This is where people are learning to not just to not accept physical reality for what it is, and learning how to be imaginative, and learning how to attract what they want, and then creating like crazy and so forth. You know, so clearly, this, physical life is not a bad thing at all.
Right.
It's just you don't want to pay all your attention to that, because then you're missing out on the experience. And I think that's really what the message is. The big experience is in the imagination.
Right. And that's the point I think is so strong here, too, is that the passive use of imagination isn't going to actively create anything.
Right.
And he goes on to say, he delights in the gift of Abel, the active, voluntary, loving exercise of the imagination. So when we actively use it instead of passively use it, I think that's the difference.
It is.
He quotes Joel, "Let the weak man say, I am strong." And says, let man disregard appearances and declare himself to be the man he wants to be. Let him imagine beauty where his senses reveal ashes, joy where they testify to mourning, riches where they bear witness to poverty. Only by such active, voluntary use of imagination can man be lifted up and Eden restored. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say, I feel like at some point we've read Neville talking about Eden, but not often. So I'm not sure what he considers it to be.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that. I think we did kind of touch on it.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, the first or second book, actually, that we read anyway.
So he says the ideal is always waiting to be incarnated. Just, I know that that sentence isn't complete at that point. There's a comma, but just that thought, the ideal. Because, you know, often we say, well, there are ideals, and then there's reality,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we all have ideals, and then there's reality. But Neville says the ideal is always waiting to be incarnated. But unless we ourselves offer the ideal to the Lord, our consciousness, by assuming that we're already that which we seek to embody, it is incapable of birth. The Lord needs his daily lamb of faith to mold the world in harmony with our dreams. So our consciousness needs us to use our imagination in an active way.
Mm-hmm.
By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. Faith sacrifices the apparent fact for the unapparent truth. Faith holds fast to the fundamental truth that through the medium of an assumption, invisible states become visible facts. Then he quotes St. Augustine, "For what is faith unless it is to believe what you do not see?" And I think that that's important always to remember, is that faith always is the result of believing something that you couldn't see. Like if we could see it, if we had the sensations of it, if it was something we could touch, we wouldn't have to have faith to believe it. And we're not talking about blind faith here. We're talking about our imagination. So there's a difference in just, we're not saying to just believe anything anybody tells you. We're talking about being able to tap into our imagination and that ideal, and then have faith that we can make it happen. So some mm-hmm. of the faith is in ourself, right? It's faith in our ability to create things.
I also have been noticing a lot in my own development lately how, oh, geez, I don't know how to characterize it. I don't want to say small because that makes it sound mm-hmm. insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
How relatively less important in my process faith is.
Really?
Yeah.
That's because, interesting.
And the reason I say that is, as I go through life, as I try to manifest things, focus on stuff, imagine stuff, and so forth, when I'm in the act of imagining, at that point in time, there's no need for faith. Faith is irrelevant to that activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the act of imagining, the act of playing out vignettes, as we like to call them.
Right.
When I'm doing that action, I don't even have to think about faith. Faith
I agree.
Faith is outside of that. The only time I ever even consider the question of faith is when I'm no longer doing a vignette imagination and then sitting back and saying, well, why hasn't it happened yet? And right. Now all of a sudden I feel like, oh, I got to start talking about faith.
Well, or something contrary comes up, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you have a vignette and then something happens after you're out of your imaginative space.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens that on the surface looks like there's no way this thing can happen you've been imagining, because look what this says, right? Look what the letter that just came in the mail says, right?
Yes,
or whatever. And so that's when the faith is important. And I like to think of faith, because I am completely divorcing the concept of faith from religion,
mm-hmm.
or spirituality even. I just like to call it a knowing. It's being convinced in my own self that this, whatever is written on this letter, I'm just using an example, isn't going to matter. It's not the final say.
Right.
That my imagination is going to have more power than whatever I'm seeing in the outside world telling me otherwise. That's the faith that I'm talking about.
I think you're right. I also want to add the fact that as time has gone on, most recently within the last year or two, 3 years, I've spent a lot more time, like a larger chunk of time on a daily basis, doing my imagining.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be, I can remember when I first started doing all this stuff after reading The Secret, that my imaginings would last about 5 seconds and I was done for the day. You know, but I've gotten to the point now, partly through, you know, preaching it here on the show, and partly just because I wanted to keep building myself up and developing, I've gotten to the point where I'm going through large chunks of the day imagining. And as a result of that, it's becoming a more familiar way of living. It's a bigger reality. It's a bigger part of my day-to-day reality. And because it's a bigger part of my day-to-day reality, that's why I made the comment, the faith issue has gone away, because now I'm spending a whole lot less time outside of that imaginative space and a lot more time inside that imaginative space.
And you know, what's interesting is that we talk about having to have faith when our eyes can't see the results right. yet. But when you're in that imaginative space, you are seeing it in your imagination. So yeah. No faith is necessary.
None.
And so
nope.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Even though,
yeah.
Even though here we are, we're reading Neville's chapter on faith and we're like, yeah, it doesn't really matter. All right. So he's going to tell us a story. So let's see. He says,
okay.
He says just recently, which I can't remember when this book was written, but it wasn't recently.
Well, I can look that up. While you're telling the story, I'll look it up. Actually, I says, got it right here. It says it was published in 1956. So
okay.
Yeah, it's a few years back.
Been a while. He says, I had the opportunity to observe the wonderful results of one who had the faith to believe what she did not see. A young woman asked me to meet her sister and her 3-year-old nephew. He was a fine, healthy lad with clear blue eyes and an exceptionally fine, unblemished skin. Then she told me her story. At birth, the boy was perfect in every way, save for a large, ugly birthmark covering one side of his face. The doctor advised them that nothing could be done for this type of scar. Visits to many specialists only confirmed his statement. Hearing the verdict, the aunt set herself the task of proving her faith, that an assumption, though denied by the evidence of the senses, if persisted in, will harden into fact. Every time she thought of the baby, which was often, she saw in her imagination an 8-month-old baby with a perfect face without any trace of a scar. This was not easy, but she knew that in this case, that was the gift of Abel, which pleased God. She persisted in her faith. She believed what was not there to be seen. The result was that she visited her sister on the child's 8-month birthday and found him to have a perfect, unblemished skin with no trace of a birthmark ever having been present. Luck! Coincidence! Shouts Cain. No. Abel knows that these are names given by those who have no faith to the works of faith. We walk by faith, not by sight. When reason and the facts of life oppose the idea you desire to realize, and you accept the evidence of your senses and the dictates of reason as the truth, you have brought the Lord, your consciousness, the gift of Cain. It is obvious that such offerings do not please him. Life on earth is a training ground for image making. If you use only the molds which your senses dictate, there will be no change in your life. You are here to live the more abundant life, so that you must use the invisible molds of imagination and make results and accomplishments the crucial test of your power to create. Only as you assume the feeling of the wish fulfilled and continue therein are you offering the gift that pleases. When Abel's gift is my attire, then I'll realize my desire. Mm-hmm. The prophet Malachi complains that man has robbed God. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Facts based upon reason and the evidence of the senses which oppose the idea seeking expression rob you of the belief in the reality of the invisible state. But faith is the evidence of things not seen. And through it, good calleth those things which be not, as though they were. Call the thing not seen. Assume the feeling of your wish fulfilled. That there may be meat in my house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Interesting that he uses these particular verses, but I like the fact that he talks about, again, that about robbing us of the belief in the reality of the invisible state.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the more we focus on what is and call that reality, the less we can have that kind of faith that knows that there are other things happening. You know, one of the things, I'm sure Neville does this and lots of people do, using the metaphor of planting seeds, like seeds of intention, and then having them grow into something. And I always think about how gardens seem dormant or are dormant for some part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we've planted the seeds and we've watered and watered and still nothing's happening, we just have to believe that, well, they are going to come up. And if we've planted them before and they've sprouted, we may say to ourselves, oh, I plant these kind of seeds every year. It takes about 4 weeks and then they start to sprout and we don't worry about it. But when we're planting something we've never planted before,
mm-hmm.
sometimes, you know, I would tell my clients, well, you just keep walking by that little patch and it's just a patch of dirt, 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 dirt every day. It's just dirt. It's just dirt, right? Dirt. But under that dirt, on the surface, it looks like nothing's happening, but underneath, there's all kinds of things happening,
mm-hmm.
right? There's worms down there that are, you know, moving the dirt around so that the water can get to the seeds. The seeds are starting to germinate. They're starting to struggle their way up through the dirt. Like all kinds of stuff is going on. Mm-hmm. So in those times when it seems like nothing is happening, that's when we have faith and we know, no, there is something happening, because Neville talks right here of this invisible, right? Seeing the reality, believing the reality of the invisible state.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff going on we can't see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something that maybe five people might have seen on Facebook when I posted it, because not many people seem to have seen it at all. But among those who did see it, they probably were confused by it. So I want to bring it in here just to see if I can clear up the confusion, because it also ties into what we're talking about here. I've been giving a lot of attention lately on my spare time when I'm not doing programming and podcasts to a philosophical question, the question of objectivity versus subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not something most LOA people pay attention to. This is pretty much outside the norm. But for me, it's a big deal. And I won't give you all of the origins of where my exploration came from, other than to say I noticed some time back that ultimately everything that we talk about here on the show about imagining and about the malleability of the physical world and so forth all points to the world being a subjective world rather than an objective world.
Yeah.
Now, when you do programming, when you do computer programming, there's a rather large aspect of it called object-oriented programming. Basically, you model whatever it is that you're trying to make the program do based on concepts that are like objects. So, you know, you right. if you want your thing to be able to print, you work with a printer object in order to print, which all kind of seems, you know, straightforward. But as I was thinking about it lately, I was thinking to myself, well, really, we are the creators. We are the ones who manipulate the stuff, who can make it malleable and change it, change the state. Talking about that invisible state, changing it with our imagination to this new state. We're the ones who are capable of doing that. I wonder if perhaps we're using the wrong terminology. Shouldn't we call that subject-oriented programming?
Because it's all happening in our head.
And because it is literally, I even looked up the word subject. Subject basically means under our control. When you look at the right. Latin derivatives of it, it basically means to throw under, to throw under your own control. Whereas to objectify, when we objectify something, we are essentially saying it's outside of our control. We look at these objects and we, you know, it's like me trying to imagine, I have a tissue box here, me trying to imagine I am going to, you know, force this tissue box to turn itself into a lamp. Mm-hmm. And that seems impossible because I feel that this is an object. I can feel it. I can touch it. This is an object. Objects are outside of my control is what it feels like. Mm-hmm. It isn't until I can turn that object into a subject of my imagination that I could start turning it into something else. And how that will actually manifest, I can't say, because we're still in the process of learning how to do all this stuff, but I know that it will change. I know that it will change if I change it subjectively. So why bring up this whole thing about subjective versus objective? I think it's more useful to start thinking about things subjectively than objectively. Taking the idea out of our minds that physical stuff out there is outside of our control, and focusing instead on what isn't in within our control, which is what goes on inside our minds, what goes on inside our imagination, where we can actually turn it into a subject and literally subject it to our will.
Reminds me of how a king, right, refers to his subjects.
Yes.
Right? So we're elevating our imagination to that place where everything is our subject.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So awesome.
A little esoteric, but...
I like it. Hey, esoteric. Neville loves this stuff, right?
This is true.
All right, another story, which I'm really thankful for, because I think when Neville gives us these stories, it really helps us understand his concepts.
Oh, yes. Story from Sacramento, California. He doesn't usually name a particular place, so that's kind of cool.
He says... who refuse to accept the evidence of their senses, who refuse to be robbed in spite of a seeming loss. The wife had given her husband a very valuable wristwatch. The gift doubled its value because of the sentiment he attached to it. They had a little ritual with the watch. Every night, as he removed the watch, he gave it to her, and she put it away in a special box in the bureau. Every morning, she took the watch and gave it to him to put on. One morning... the watch was missing.
Ooh.
They both remembered playing their usual parts the night before. Therefore, the watch was not lost or misplaced, but stolen. Then and there, they determined not to accept the fate that it was really gone. They said to each other, "This is an opportunity to practice what we believe." They decided that in their imagination, they would enact their customary ritual as though the watch were actually there. In his imagination, every night the husband took off the watch and gave it to his wife, while in her imagination she accepted the watch and carefully put it away. Every morning she removed the watch from its box and gave it to her husband, and he in turn put it on. They did this faithfully for 2 weeks. After their 14-day vigil, a man went into the one and only jewelry store in Sacramento where the watch would be recognized. As he offered a gem for appraisal, the owner of the store noticed the wristwatch he was wearing. Under the pretext of needing a closer examination of the stone, he went into an inner office and called the police. After the police arrested the man, they found in his apartment over $10,000 worth of stolen jewelry. In walking by faith, not by sight, this couple attained their desire, the watch, and also aided many others in regaining what had seemed to be lost forever.
Interesting.
He quotes, he closes this chapter with a quote from Thoreau. He says, if one advances confidently in the direction of his dream and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours.
I love that last story, in part because so many stories we hear, they're the perfect manifestation stories, right? Everything is just so nice and light and fluffy, and everything just works out so beautifully. You don't hear a lot of manifestation stories that include something that went wrong. And from the thief's point of view, things went really, really wrong. Now, did that thief manifest
from the man and wife, things went pretty wrong, you know, at opening
first.
Of it. I mean, to open the box and have the thing not be there, that's not a good way to start the day.
But for them, the story turned out with a nice, happy ending. For the thief, it turned out with a very unhappy ending.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is that, first of all, I like the fact that it includes both aspects in the story. Second of all, the fact that the thief's part of the story comes out in a way that the thief really didn't want to have happen, although Joel might actually argue with me on this because he claims that the best thing that ever happened to him was being thrown in prison because then all his fear disappeared.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I'm going to imagine that this thief really didn't want to be caught with all that, you know, $10,000 worth of loot that he had stolen over whatever period of time it was. You know, so he ended up with a result he didn't want, but it was exactly the result he was leading up to. He had been focusing on that result for the longest period of time, and he ended up getting it. You know, so the law of attraction, Neville doesn't actually use the term law of attraction, but that's basically what he's talking about. The law of attraction worked out perfectly for everybody who was involved here, including the thief. That's why I love that story.
I like this story because, it reminded me of a story that one of my friends told me about having an animal that was lost.
Mm.
And it was during the wintertime. It was kind of like when your cat got out in the deep snow, and it didn't come home, and it didn't come home. And she was getting really, really upset, but she recognized that if she didn't, that she could feel the animal there if she didn't miss him.
Mm.
And when she said that, I was like, whoa, like if I could sense him here with me. Like she talked about how when the animal was at home, just everyday life, normal stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the animal was in the other room, sleeping in its bed. She couldn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't worry.
True.
It was in the other room, in its bed.
Yep.
But now it was somewhere she didn't know where it was.
Right.
And as time went on, it was more and more, you know, likely that maybe he had died or whatever. And so suddenly she decided, you know what? There's been plenty of times when I didn't see him and I didn't worry at all. And I could even sense him here because I knew he was in the other room. So she began to correct her course imaginatively and not let herself worry or miss him. She just said, oh, he's fine. I go through this all the time. I do things through my day plenty of times when I don't see him.
Mm-hmm.
And more time went by. I mean, more time kept going by where it was really scary and really like, okay. And suddenly he appeared at the door and she let him in and he wasn't even wet. Like it was like, you know, snowing outside. And it was just as if he'd always been there. So when I heard this story, it really had an impact on me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tie this together with our story because I had some jewelry stolen.
Oh, really?
That was very sentimental. Right? Like the expensive jewelry didn't get stolen. It was the thing that, you know, that had. Right. and so for a while I was actually doing this. I was in my imagination, especially when I was falling asleep at night. You know, I can still remember these are two pieces that were given to me by parents. And I mean, I can remember exactly what they look like. I don't have to stress out over what did it look like. I know exactly what they look like. I have pictures of me wearing these pieces, and I know what they felt like. Like, I know what they feel like when I'm wearing them. And so I would just imagine, and suddenly all of the grief over them being stolen and the grief over them being lost was just gone because I'm like, hey, when they were over there, just like my friend's cat, right? It's like, when these pieces of jewelry were over in my jewelry box and I was in bed at night, maybe they were over there. I couldn't see them. Mm-hmm. But I knew they were there. And I knew how much I loved them and enjoyed them and how special they were to me. And so I had a period of time where it was the period that I was really upset. I would just do that and the upsetness would go away. But now reading this story, I thought maybe I need to, this may be the vignette that I need to create because maybe I can actually have them return to me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I really liked this one. I was like, huh, this is good.
I think you should go for it. I mean, seriously. I mean, wouldn't it be great to actually reproduce the story in your own life? So usually these stories are metaphorical. They represent things that can happen so we can identify that way. But in this case, you could actually experience what this person in the story experienced.
I know.
Literally.
So I was reading it and I was like, oh, getting really excited. And tying it into, you know, my friend's idea of I could sense my pet here with me if I wasn't missing him. And I thought, I have to stop grieving over this loss. I have to stop being angry over the loss and upset about it. And remember what it felt like before they were stolen, when I knew they were over there in the drawer or whatever, right? It's like, was fine with it. I would think about them and be happy that I had them and what they meant to me. So, yeah, I think I'm going to have to go over to the room that you set up for the vignettes and post that one. I haven't put one over there yet because I've been trying to think of one that I want to kind of put experimentally, and I think this is it. So,
well, it's interesting you should mention that. I forgot to mention the room when we did our promotional messages, but I really should be including that in the promotional messages because I want to invite everybody who is a listener who has not yet joined that group to come to Facebook. Just do a search for Law of Attraction Pivot Pals, and you'll find it. And ask to become a member, we'll let you in, of course. Just come in and be a part of what we're doing, because what we're literally doing is we're posting vignettes. And then we're, you know, commenting on each other's vignettes and supporting each other with our comments and then using it as a reminder to go back and replay our vignettes in our minds. So literally every day, I shared a video that I created a while back that I'm using to try to attract three different things. And I'm playing that video every single day and recording in the comments. Okay, I played it today. Another 6 minutes played, you know, or, you know, some comment to that effect. And what it really does is it kind of, not forces, but it kind of trains us to do the thing we always say we should be doing but don't really do, which is to keep playing the vignette every day. I mean, all of these stories, these Neville stories are all about they did it every single day for two straight weeks, you know, or for 4 weeks or whatever it is.
Don't you think that's kind of amazing how many times that you get to the end of the story and it says 2 weeks later.
2 weeks later,
yes. 3 weeks later. It's always like 2 or 3 weeks, you know. It's not like 5 years later. I mean, there may be one that's 5 years later, but most of them are weeks. And I think it's the consistency.
Mm-hmm.
The consistency. True. Yeah.
Yep.
That's why I think it's important. Like, I don't like to have a ton of different vignettes and I don't like them to be overly detailed. I know it's different for everybody, but I like them to be short, simple, and I like to work on one until it unfolds instead of, because if I keep creating new ones, then I don't stick with any of them.
That's the key. Yeah. Sticking with it. Going back and revisiting.
Yeah.
Making it real over time. Because the more that we revisit it, the more real we make it in our imaginations.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because the ones that I have stuck with the most, and this may have to do with just who I am as a person. And also, you know, I'm a coach. And part of my coaching deals with, a lot of it deals with relationship, because I see everything as a relationship. It's like your relationship to money, your relationship to your partner, your relationship to, you know, your home, whatever.
Sure.
But I have so much success with going back and imagining a conversation in a different way. Mm-hmm. A conversation that was stressful, or a conversation where somebody said something that felt painful. Going back and remembering that conversation in a different way. And I teach my clients to do this as well. Especially sometimes when someone has had, you know, a discussion that wasn't, that was less than wonderful. Sometimes we call those arguments.
Yes.
Sometimes there will be one particular thing that they pull out, you know, one or two sentences that just go around in their head, like they can't stop thinking about that one thing. that either they said or the other person said, or maybe both, just an exchange. And I often say, I want you to just, what do you wish you would have said? Mm-hmm. Or what do you, and how do you wish they would have responded? And just imagine that that's what happened in the conversation. So that's like a vignette, you know, just a conversation. And so many times there's a miracle that happens in the relationship because of that work. And so I'm really good at doing that and helping people do that. The other more physical kind of things, like jewelry coming back or whatever, sometimes I don't stick with it. And I think that's the key there, is that consistency. So I'm excited about using the space that you set up in the Facebook room to kind of be an accountability thing. Plus, well, I just announced it on the podcast. So now
you kind of have to do it, right? Yeah, that's like an accountability thing at that point.
Yeah, well, I do that. Like, if I'm going to do a certain thing, if I have ideas about doing a certain thing, and I just keep it to myself, that, but if I announce it somewhere, or I go over to Facebook or, you know, on social media, or call my friend and say, this is what I'm going to do, then it's like, okay, I'm committed now because I've announced it. So, yeah, so I think it's a good thing. I think people should come over there and join us in creating a vignette.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a really supportive group. It's a great group. I mean, I think it's easily the most positive group on Facebook. It may be small at this point, but I think it's easily the most positive, happy group on Facebook.
Awesome.
Everything. I never a discouraging word is heard. I mean,
well, that's good. We need places like that right now. We need
absolutely
positive spaces. Yeah, where we can go and we can dream our dream and put our vignette out there and have other people support it.
By the way, I love what you were describing, because you were describing Neville's pruning shears of revision. You were,
yes.
When you're talking about, you know, right, changing the story around, that's exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah.
How cool that you're talking about that on Neville Day. It's appropriate.
Well, you know, I love that maybe 2 years ago I came across an article that was talking about neural connections in the brain that are no longer used.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like one of the examples I could probably give is that I live down here in Louisiana, where we have a very short, mild winter and a very long, hot summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a knitter, but I don't like to knit in the summer. It's too much to have yarn on your hands, and it's too hot. And I just, but as soon as it starts getting cold, I want to knit. Every year, almost every year, I have to look something up. And I've been knitting for decades, right? Just like, wait, how do I do that again? Because I haven't used that skill or talent or whatever in a year.
Right.
Right. And so what happens is, that's why muscle memory, things come easier to us as we learn them. Like the stuff you're learning right now, you're like, oh yeah, it's definitely getting easier. Mm-hmm. But if you don't do any of that stuff for a couple of years, when you come back to it, you'll often have to kind of relearn it a little bit. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the neural connections, like not being used. But there's actually something, and they have a name for it that I can't remember now. But they call it pruning. Like, it's a brain function that your brain has where it will get rid of things that's not being used anymore, connections that aren't being used. And they actually call it pruning.
Cool.
So when I read Neville say pruning shears of revision, right, I was like, oh, I mean, because all of this is brain science, right?
It is.
We know that. It's just brain science.
Yeah, it's true. It really is.
We
by the way,
I
want to make sure we don't miss this, because usually we do these shows and it's just, we do the shows about the book because that's what it's about. But Jeffrey, of course, is our most faithful live stream listener. And he has a question regarding what we just read. So I want to make sure I bring it in.
Oh, yeah.
He says, is there any discussion of Cain murdering Abel? Because, of course, that's a big part of the biblical story of Cain murdering Abel.
Right.
And it doesn't actually appear in this particular chapter, but I don't think it's too far of a stretch to kind of imagine what Neville would say about that.
Well, I'm actually glad that you brought it up, because I thought about it as soon as we started reading the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I started wondering how Neville would deal with that. And I don't know if he deals with it moving forward. But, you know, the idea that, it makes a lot of sense, right? The idea that our logical mind, what is, right? Mm-hmm. We always say, but that's just the way it is. And I always tell my coaching clients, anytime you hear yourself say, well, that's just how it is, let that be a big red flag to you.
Right.
right? That you are stuck somewhere, and that you're not seeing the potential that could happen. You're not seeing possibility. And so, and it's a big red flag that there's some kind of limiting belief going on. Oh, that's just the way it is. So I think that that kills.
It does.
The potential.
Mm-hmm.
That's Cain killing Abel. That's right. I mean,
I think it can even become a little bit more literal than that. I mean, if Cain represents the senses and the evidences of the senses, and Abel represents the imagination and using the imagination creatively, then what we're talking about is the evidence of the senses murdering the creation using imagination. In other words, letting the senses say, don't do any imagining.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad, Jeffrey, that you brought that up, because I did. I saw it when we first started reading, and I was like, oh, I actually thought Neville was going to go there, because that is like the part of the story you always hear, right?
Right.
And so I was like, oh, I know where he's going. So far, he hasn't gone there. But I think it's a great discussion.
Well, the book has obviously more chapters to come, so we may get more there. But even if he doesn't go there, I think it's just kind of implicit in what he was saying. I mean, all that chapter was about... how did he say it? Don't give any respect, or as we changed it, regard to Cain, to the evidence of the senses. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Well, it's that that our consciousness, our imagination, doesn't have any regard for a passive use. Our consciousness, which Neville described as being like the womb of creation, that's where the creations happen, in our consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that our consciousness, which he says the Lord, our consciousness has no regard for passive use of the imagination. It doesn't start creating anything when we're using imagination passively. It just replicates whatever's already been happening. We don't need, you know, much consciousness to do that, right?
Certainly during the time that Neville was giving his talks and writing this book, it was a very heavily strong tendency for people to be in that rational, logical mindset. That was a big part of the 1950s and 40s and 60s, that very, very rational mindset. Mm-hmm. And it continues to this day, but I just remember how strong it was when I was growing up. I mean, that was like the big teaching, and I learned it really, really well. And I learned to try to apply it really, really well, much to my detriment, but nevertheless, I did learn it really, really well. And when you learn that, you do learn to put the imagination aside, because the imagination interferes with that. Right? The rigors of logic and reason don't allow for imagination. You're just supposed to follow, you know, the logic and the reason. Of course, the part that they leave out is that if you're going to start piecing together things logically and reasonably, then you actually have to start imagining stuff. Otherwise, you won't know what to put in line one after another. But nevertheless, we tend to learn.
We do need both halves of our brain.
We do need both
halves of our brain.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just a great point. When we spend so much time on that logic and reason side, we are literally pushing that imaginative side apart, apart from ourselves. And it's counterproductive to do that. So, yeah, good chapter for today. Good thing to incorporate into our day-to-day life, including the work that we do. And as say that, thinking, okay, so what can I do to increase my level of imagination while I'm learning computer programming? The very time when I have to be most concerned with logic and reason and step-by-step ordering of things.
Well, you can imagine it being easier.
Well, I can imagine it being easier, but I also, kidding aside, really, when you're doing programming, yes, you have to do that step-by-step thing. But if you're losing sight of the imagination, your product, your final product, is going to come up short. That imagination has to drive the whole process. Mm-hmm. And it's what I actually like about this this new platform I'm working on. It's a form of programming that allows you to piece stuff together quickly, comparatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly is always a relative term, right? Well, in this case, it's particularly relative. But relative to other programming methods, you can put it together relatively quickly, so that gives you more time to do the imagining of how do you want this final computer program look when it's all done? How do you want it to function? You know, what are all the different pieces that you want it to be able to do? What are all the cool bells and whistles that you want? You can think about that stuff because you're not so wrapped up in that step-by-step stuff. So Good stuff. Before we finish up for the day, I want to give you the opportunity to tell people how to reach out to Cindy Chavez, life coach, because as you point out, you are a life coach and a pretty
I am. They can find me at CindyChavez.com. It's CindyChavez. There's a contact form there. I would love to hear from you.
Fabulous stuff. Thank you very much, Cindy. I mean, the good news is we get to do this once a week. The bad news is we only do it once a week, but I love doing Neville Day. It is so much fun. So
well,
thank you
I'll
very
be
much.
Here next time.
I'll be here as well. We hope that you'll join us as well next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.